Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we bring you a talk by New Yorker staff writer George Packer. The talk was given in Eugene on January 24th as part of the University of Oregon Humanities Center 2017-18 Criticos Lecture in the Humanities. The talk is titled American Identity in the Age of Trump. What makes this talk so relevant and important is that Packer takes the long view of political history to try and understand how we got to this moment in our national history. He makes the case that our current situation is not a product of a single election cycle, or even three election cycles, but has its roots in the 1970s. He also argues against the idea that America can be explained by a map colored by red and blue states, but rather that there's something deeper at work, that on the one hand is a challenge of global proportions, but that also offers the possibility that we might have more in common than we appear to. Here's Packer.
The title of my talk feels audacious and preposterous because we're still figuring this out. We don't know. We don't know what's going on. Something I keep coming back to. I'm going to do my best tonight to give my shot at kind of a brief history and a lay of the landscape of where we are. But I want to preface it by saying we really don't know yet. We're figuring it out. We're in uncharted territory. So almost 10 years ago, I set out to write a book about what happened in America over the generation that coincided with my adult life, and perhaps yours. And that was a large subject. Large subjects are best approached, in my experience, through small dramas. I wanted to create a portrait of the country through the stories of a handful of Americans. It was the depths of the Great Recession, and I began traveling around the country, sometimes as a New Yorker magazine writer, more often on my own dime, mainly to out-of-the-way places that the media tends to overlook. The tobacco and textile region of North Carolina, the decayed industrial city of Youngstown, Ohio, and the new subdivisions around Tampa Bay, which almost overnight had become ghost subdivisions. I met people in these places who became what writers call characters, meaning the subjects of stories. They were not famous. In fact, they thought of themselves as so ordinary that some of them couldn't understand why I was interested. But they let me spend months following them around, asking impertinent questions, getting to know them in a deeper way than just one interview would allow. I liked listening to them. I liked them. And they knew how to hold my attention. And plus, they were willing to put up with me. Their stories allowed me to get at my bigger theme, the decline of America's democratic institutions. It's actually satisfying to have your preconceived ideas upended. This is one of the great things about journalism, in fact. While I was doing this reporting, I kept meeting Americans who didn't match the familiar red-blue scheme. They might be white Southern country people, but they hated corporations and big box stores as well as the federal government. There was a lawyer who kept imagining he almost seemed to be welcoming an apocalyptic vision of armed citizens turning to political violence. There was the black community organizer who talked down the mentality of victimhood. There was the ex-lobbyist who wanted to punish Wall Street executives with sweeping legal reforms and jail time. They followed the Tea Party, but sounded a little like Occupy Wall Street, or vice versa. They were loose molecules, unattached to any party hierarchies, more individualistic than most Democrats, more anti-business than most Republicans. Now, the left-right division was not wrong. There was no centrist silent majority waiting to elect Michael Bloomberg president. Aided by cable news and social media, Americans have sorted themselves geographically and mentally into mutually hostile and incomprehensible worlds. By some measures, our polarization is wider and fiercer than at any time since the run-up to the Civil War. Political scientists have actually taken to estimating the chances of a second Civil War breaking out. I saw a figure of about 30%, which really alarmed me. Now, if you graph this political polarization using data like voting patterns in Congress, it tracks quite closely with two other major phenomena of the past 40 years: rising levels of inequality and rising levels of immigration. These trends all started to increase in the mid to late 70s, and it's an important task to figure out what the trend lines have to do with one another. Why was post-war America, with a broad middle class, wider distribution of wealth, stronger institutions, more ethnic homogeneity, and higher levels of political participation, less polarized than America today? The simple answer, I think, is that a smaller pie divided into less and less equal slices among people who look less and less alike drives them towards cynical and hateful extremes. My point for now is that the red-blue map could be redrawn in a new way that would explain the landscape differently and perhaps more accurately as up-down. From this point of view, the affluent on each side of the divide have more in common with one another than they do with the voters down below. A network systems administrator, an oil and gas company vice president, a journalist, and a dermatologist hire nannies from the same countries, dine out at the same Thai restaurants, travel abroad on the same frequent flyer miles, and invest in the same emerging markets index funds. They might have different political views, but they share a common interest in the existing global order and its survival. But for those in the lower half or two-thirds, globalization does not have much of an upside. It might lower prices at Walmart, but it will give their job to a robot or a foreigner or eliminate it altogether. The Americans I met in these ranks were unorganized, unheard, unspoken for, and they were sinking, alone. They were part of a trend toward geographic and social immobility in towns and rural areas. Isolation was a common condition. Among all the people I wrote about, the only one with a network of relations that could provide help when she needed it was an Indian immigrant in Tampa who managed to save her motel from bank foreclosure thanks to an extended family in Florida, England, and Gujarat. As for the native-born Americans, they were pretty much on their own. Another family in Tampa, the Hartzels, who were white, had no support of any kind from friends, family, or institutions. They were always on the edge of homelessness, and eventually they were living with their two children in their broken-down car in a Walmart parking lot. Since most of the stores in their neighborhood were owned by Asians and Latinos, the Hartzels clung to the false belief that immigrants received 7 years of government benefits after arriving in America. It was the only explanation they could come up with. Danny Hartzel was trapped by part-time work in a Target stockroom with a schedule that changed from day to day at the company's whim, and sometimes reduced his weekly hours to the vanishing point. Now, in Studs Terkel's oral history, Working, written in the early 70s, you kept meeting people trapped in monotonous jobs they hated that turned them into numbers and cogs. But for someone like Danny Hartzel, that looks like enviable job security. The people I wrote about believed that the middle class was gone, that the game was rigged for the powerful and connected, and that their children were screwed. They saw money going to the top or out of the country or to the undeserving down below. There was a pervasive fear of scams and a longing for simple explanations. And these feelings easily turned to anxiety, nostalgia, and an impulse to blame the other, Black Americans, coastal urban elites, Muslims, immigrants. and the institutions of middle-class democracy, government, business, media, school, bank, union, church, civic group, all seemed remote and geared just for the benefit of those who run them. And no institution has been guiltier of this abandonment than the two political parties. Now, I'm going to really oversimplify the history here, but for most of the 20th century, the Democrats were the party of the fair shake, and the Republicans were the party of getting ahead. Workers' interests versus business interests. And these identities persisted until the early 70s. And then two big changes came. After the debacle of the 68 convention in Chicago, the Democrats reformed themselves, shrinking the power of unions and urban machines, increasing the power of younger activists who were more concerned with issues like the rights of disenfranchised groups, militarism, government corruption, the environment. These activists, many of whom were educated professionals, eventually took over the party. And with Bill Clinton's election, they claimed national power. In the 90s, the Democrats embraced globalization as the way of the future and education as the key to success. It sounds incredible now, but in 2000 at a White House conference on the new economy, do you remember that phrase, the new economy? Bill Clinton said the internet would be the greatest engine for reducing poverty in the history of the world. It didn't quite turn out like that. On the Republican side, starting in the 70s, the party became an increasingly conservative marriage of the rich and downscale whites, many of them evangelical Christians. From being the boring party of Babbitt and order, Republicans were seized with a new populist energy. They became a kind of workers' party, but only white workers, and led, strangely enough, by the Koch brothers. For a long time, it seemed like a winning coalition with a powerful ideology, but it was stained by a nihilism that came from the top and sludged downward to the grassroots. It fed on rage and the spectacle of celebrity pop culture. Media demagogues like Limbaugh, Drudge, Breitbart, Coulter, Hannity came on the scene with all the viciousness of the 1930s radio broadcasts of Father Coughlin. Republican office holders found the will to deploy every available weapon, investigation, impeachment, Supreme Court majority vote, filibuster, government shutdown, that's now gone to the other side, conspiracy theories, and even implied threats of violence to secure power and destroy their political enemies. This is really the most important political development of my adult life, this descending nihilism of the right. In the fall of 2008, I was reporting on the presidential campaign in Gloucester, Ohio, which is Appalachia. I sat down with a group of women who were excited by politics for the first time in their lives. The reason was named Sarah Palin. She'd fit right in with us, they said. This told me that something new was happening in Republican politics. Populism was taking over. Being a Wasilla Walmart mom had become a qualification for the highest office, even the main qualification. Palin's campaign appearances turned working-class whiteness into identity politics. She strutted on stage to the beat of Gretchen Wilson's Redneck Woman. She even had a pregnant, unwed teenage daughter. In her proud ignorance, her contempt for institutions, and her infatuation with her own celebrity and her unrestrained narcissism, Palin was John the Baptist for Donald Trump. What happened to our institutions? They stopped meeting the aspirations of those at the bottom, while those at the top stopped believing in interests larger than their own. We can't live without elites, for better or worse, but elites with no sense of responsibility are the worst case scenario. They did not used to be better people. Human nature doesn't change. But they were held in check by certain taboos, and social constraints. Today, elites and institutions have largely been replaced by celebrities. Celebrities dominate ordinary people's lives like household gods. In times of opportunity, the distance between these gods and the mortals closes. The monuments shrink closer to human size. The lives of America's celebrities become gossipy diversions. But they loom larger in times when inequality is high, trust in institutions is low, and the normal paths of upward mobility are blocked. Extreme celebrity worship speaks of a weakening of ordinary people's faith in themselves, in self-government. To me, it's a symptom of democratic decay. Our celebrities all live by the hacker's code. Ask forgiveness, not permission. They obliterate old distinctions between high and low culture, profit-making and philanthropy, business and politics, leading to the phenomenon of being famous for being famous. The inevitable next step is for Kim Kardashian to sit on the board of a tech startup, host a global poverty awareness event, and write a book on popular neuroscience. Or for Trump to be elected president. So given this landscape that I've described, it should not have come as a complete surprise when millions of Americans were suddenly drawn to a crass strongman who tossed out fraudulent promises and gave institutions and elites the middle finger. My book did not predict Trump, but it did describe the early warning signs of something like Trumpism. And the fact that so many informed and sophisticated Americans not only failed to see him coming, but kept writing him off throughout the campaign and in a sense still regard him as a ludicrous aberration is itself a sign of a democracy with no center. Most of Trump's critics are too reasonable to fathom his kind of politics. Some don't even know a single Trump supporter, but to fight Trump, you have to understand his appeal. During the campaign in 2016, I interviewed a steelworker outside Canton. He was on a picket line as a result of a lockout and facing months without a paycheck, possibly even the loss of his job. And he too talked about the end of the middle class. He struck me as a thoroughly decent, thoughtful man, but he found Trump's endless insults refreshing, even exhilarating. This ugliness for him was a kind of revenge. He said, "It's a mirror of the way they see us. Trump is like a mirror of their image of us." He did not specify who they and us were, but maybe he didn't have to. Maybe he included me among the they. Maybe he believed, he was far too respectful to say it, that people like me didn't really give a shit about people like him. And maybe he didn't care that Trump's friend and advisor, Carl Icahn, was responsible for the loss of hundreds of union factory jobs in Canton, resulting from leveraged buyouts. What mattered was that Trump spoke for him. "I am your voice," Trump declared at the Republican convention. Democrats scoffed, but it was powerful stuff. The lower Trump's language and behavior sank, and the more he was vilified by the media and other elites, the more he was celebrated by his own tribe. Trump is the leader, and the leader can do no wrong. During the election, we learned that lots of Republican voters are not constitutional originalists, members of the Federalist Society, or devout readers of the Wall Street Journal editorial page. They actually want government to do more things that benefit them, as opposed to benefiting people they think are undeserving. Republican leaders should have anticipated Trump's rise. After all, he was created in their laboratory of populism before he broke free and began to smash everything in sight. Trump showed that the Republican Party hasn't been truly conservative or truly Christian for many years. Its most energized elements are not trying to restore stability or institute virtue. They're driven by a sense of violent opposition against changes in color and culture that appear to be sweeping away the country they once knew, against globalization, which turns out to be a political program as revolutionary and threatening as the politics of the Jacobins and the anarchists once were. This did not happen in isolation. The populist impulse that brought Trump to power has taken hold throughout Europe and the rest of the democratic world, from Spain and Britain to Sweden and Poland, from Germany's Alternative for Deutschland to India's BJP, from Hungary's Orban to Turkey's Erdogan. This global reaction against globalism is described in the work of a Harvard political scientist, Yascha Mounk, who writes that the failures of democracies over the past generation to provide rising living standards, along with mass immigration and the advent of weaponized social media, have split apart what seemed like an inseparable idea, the idea of liberal democracy, into two kinds of polity, both harmful to the values of self-government. On the one hand, undemocratic liberalism, such as the European Union and international trade agreements and the Federal Reserve, which protect individual rights but are unresponsive to the popular will. And on the other hand, illiberal democracy, elected governments like those in Hungary and Turkey, where the people vote for leaders who trample the rights of individuals and minorities, marginalize the free press and free speech and independent courts and opposition parties, and ultimately become autocrats. I think if Trump were more competent, something like that would be happening in this country right now. People in Europe and elsewhere, they have a history with this kind of politics. At its most virulent in the 30s, it took the form of fascism. But in spite of Joe McCarthy and the plot against America, we Americans really don't know it very well. Democracy has always been our creed, unquestioned. And even the two times when it came under existential threat during the Civil War and the Great Depression, we continued to hold elections with the usual political parties. We amended rather than discarded our Constitution. No one ever got very far in American politics by trashing democracy until now. No one cause explains the 2016 election. It was too monumental for that. It was about many things. It was about race. After 8 years under a black president, Trump won in every category of white voters, regardless of income, education, age, or sex. It was about immigrants. They were Trump's favorite target. He did not do well in places that have a fairly long experience of immigration. He did best among white Americans in places that are experiencing non-white immigration for the first time. He crushed it in northwestern Iowa. He did terribly in Los Angeles and Queens. 2016 was about gender. The level of sheer hatred directed at Clinton continues to defy all explanations about her personality and her emails. The election was about the vast urban-rural divide. It was about economic anxiety. Not necessarily economic hardship. Trump supporters had a slightly higher average income than those who viewed him unfavorably. But they had low levels of education, of social capital and mobility, of hope. They saw their communities going down, their children and neighbors struggling, and they did not believe that the political elites would or even wanted to do anything about it. Now, a great deal of effort has gone into weighing and measuring these different factors, like a contest to declare the winner. I'm not even going to try. I'd only say they all tend to go together and reinforce one another. 8.5 million Americans who voted for President Obama in 2012 voted for Trump in 2016. It's a lot. He beat Clinton because he did better than Mitt Romney, and she did worse than Obama in a few key counties of the upper Midwest, North Carolina, and Florida. The voters who swung from Obama to Trump were whites without a college degree. Some other Obama voters, largely young and or black, did not turn out. So altogether, the election was about alienation. This alienation goes beyond whether you're for or against Obamacare. It actually has very little to do with policy. I interviewed Hillary Clinton a month before the election, and she laid out numerous ideas for making the economy more fair and bringing back manufacturing jobs and forcing corporations to be more responsible and breaking up tech monopolies. And as Clinton spoke, I remember thinking two things. First, why haven't I heard much of this? And second, none of it will matter on election day. It's not going to get through. The wind is blowing too hard and wild. Clinton was an incrementalist, an institutionalist in a hostile climate. In 1945, George Orwell described nationalism as, quote, the habit of identifying oneself with a single nation or other unit, placing it beyond good and evil, and recognizing no other duty than that of advancing its interests. Nationalism is inseparable from the desire for power. The abiding purpose of every nationalist is to secure more power and more prestige, not for himself, but for the nation or other unit in which he's chosen to sink his individuality. Orwell called nationalism the strongest force in the world, stronger than religious belief, socialism, or internationalism. And it still is. American nationalism today resembles other ethno-nationalisms on the rise in Europe and around the world. We still don't know the extent and effectiveness of Russian meddling in the campaign. But one thing is already clear. The Russians knew us better than we knew ourselves. They understood how divided and cynical we'd become, what easy prey to fake news stories and ginned up outrages, what shallow playthings of Twitter and Facebook. The Russians understood how our tech giants, lulled by their own success and narcissism into believing that they were unique forces for good, that an open and connected world was the best of all possible worlds, how easily these companies could be turned against our democracy. The targeting was clever and precise. Russian saboteurs and their online American collaborators knew exactly how to freak out white Christians in the small towns outside Detroit by inventing a strident local campaign against Islamophobia. It was pretty devilishly clever. And by the way, the same thing happened last fall during the Catalonian independence referendum. Some of the divisions were fueled by Russian-inspired fake news. Every society is fragile. Every society can be torn apart by forces that are nihilistic enough to try. The Russians understood there was nothing exceptional about Americans after all. We were becoming more and more like Europeans. And the weapons of information war that were already succeeding in Ukraine and Hungary and France could also be used in Arizona and Wisconsin. The Russians somehow intuited that our attachment to democracy had grown dangerously weak. Trump is driving some of it, but the trends predate him. He's more a symptom than a cause. According to research by the political scientist Yascha Mounk, Americans born in the 80s are twice as likely to consider democracy a bad form of government as those born in the 30s. Less than a third of millennials consider it essential to live in a democracy. All age groups today are more in favor of rule by a strong man than they were 20 years ago. And our attachment to liberal values is weakening along with our belief in democracy. Research shows that many Americans are ready to get rid of various freedoms. 3/4 don't think that fake news should be protected by the First Amendment. Almost half of Republicans think the government should be able to revoke a broadcast license if it says a story is false. 40% of millennials believe the government should ban statements that are offensive to minority groups. Half of Democrats think government should pass a law requiring Americans to use the preferred pronoun of transgender people. And more than half of Republicans believe that burning the flag should cost you your citizenship. 40% of all Americans don't think that religious freedom should apply to all religious groups. So it just depends on which tribe you belong to. Now, I don't want to sound sentimental, but all of these facts make me sadder than I can express to you. The essence of American politics today is a kind of tribalism. By that, I mean something close to Orwell's nationalism. fierce attachment to one's group, a constant sense of embattlement and us against them in the struggle for power, susceptibility to confusing truth with lies and merging ends with means, a readiness to submerge individual judgment and deviation in the interests of the group, a contagion of mob thinking that's greatly strengthened by social media, and longing for a leader who has simple answers for the aspirations and resentments of the group. So by tribalism, I mean the opposite of liberal democracy. The philosopher Richard Rorty foresaw much of this back in the late 90s in his book, Achieving Our Country. Rorty described the growing gap between the educated elite and the old working class. And then he wrote, at that point, something will crack. The non-suburban electorate will decide that the system has failed and start looking around for a strong man to vote for, someone willing to assure them that once he's elected, the smug bureaucrats, the tricky lawyers, overpaid bond salesmen, and postmodernist professors will no longer be calling the shots. I'm still quoting Rorty here. One thing that is very, although I kind of think he had something going on. One thing that's very likely to happen is that the gains made in the past 40 years by black and brown Americans and by homosexuals will be wiped out. Jocular contempt for women will come back into fashion. All the resentment which badly educated Americans feel about having their manners dictated to them by college graduates will find an outlet. This was in the late 90s. Now, after Trump's election, this passage enjoyed a brief fame for being rather prophetic. In the same book, Rorty also wrote this, and it's a more uplifting passage. Nations rely on artists and intellectuals to create images of, to tell stories about the national past. Competition for political leadership is in part a competition between differing stories about a nation's self-identity, between differing symbols of its greatness. The stories we tell about the past create an idea of who we are as a nation. There has never been a single idea of what that means. Politics is always a contest of narratives. The traditional old party divide between the fair shake and getting ahead has now broken up. And today in its place, I see four dominant narratives. The first narrative of American identity is libertarian America. It imagines a nation of individuals responsible for their own fates. Its key texts are the Federalist Papers and the works of Hayek and Friedman, and its watchword is freedom. Its ultimate aim is the nation without the state. This was the idea behind the Reagan Revolution. And in his words, it had the power to uplift and it transformed the political landscape, replacing what I would call the Roosevelt Republic with a new vision of limitless opportunity and a new political majority. Like all the narratives I'm describing, libertarian America has some validity to its critique. In the 70s, government did seem to fail at almost everything it tried. I was around back then and I remember. The relentless growth of the regulatory state gave unelected bureaucrats outsized power in people's lives in ways that can be stifling, sometimes even ridiculous. This is a version of what Yascha Mounk calls undemocratic liberalism. In his libertarian tract, By the People, which is almost the title of this series, the Prince of Darkness, Charles Murray, reports that the number of pages in the Code of Federal Regulations grew from 22,877 in 1960 to 174,545 in 2012. So that's by a factor of 8. It's the kind of thing a progressive would not even think to keep track of. But in Murray's narrative of American history, everything started to go off the rails in 1937, when the Supreme Court, for the first time, upheld parts of the New Deal. According to Murray, just about everything the federal government has done since then is unconstitutional. His golden age was the presidency of Grover Cleveland. In the past few decades, libertarian America has turned into the ideology of the Republican Party. It's a dogma of market fundamentalism that transferred wealth and power to corporations and to a tiny slice of individuals at the top who are well organized and willing to pay for political influence. The libertarian narrative has little to say about economic inequality, the effects of technology and globalization on ordinary Americans who don't benefit from them. In its extreme form, it's adopted a nihilistic attitude toward the normal functions of government, a willingness to see the whole structure collapse on the single-minded path to gaining power, which has become almost an end in itself. This extremism has found its way into the center of power in Congress. In American history, beginning with the founding of the Republic, the settling of the West, the end of slavery, the taming of industrialism, the struggle against economic collapse, fascism, communism, the national transportation system, the fight for equal rights, the space program, environmentalism, and the digital revolution, all of these national projects depended on a strong central government, visionary leaders, and active citizens. But the libertarian idea regards Americans as consumers, entrepreneurs, taxpayers, everything except citizens. It has no vision of self-government as the answer to people's actual needs, which is why Paul Ryan is willing to let Donald Trump trash our democracy for the sake of tax cuts for corporations and rich investors. Since the election, libertarian America remains politically alive as a class of Republican politicians, donors, and think tanks that continue to function in Washington with no connection to the party's voters. It's a head without a body. The second narrative is cosmopolitan America. This is Silicon Valley's America, in which you have to be a lifelong learner and work for the startup of you. And the transnational flow of goods and capital and information and people benefits everyone. It's the home without a home for educated professionals who more than any other group are at ease in the world that modernity has made. And for many of us, the surface of life has gotten a lot more pleasant and interesting in the last decade or two. Think of HBO, Lipitor, FedEx, E-Trade, Mileage Plus Platinum, organic grass-fed beef, gold-brewed coffee, and Amazon Prime. Cosmopolitan America comes with a breezy ideology of flattening hierarchies, disrupting old industries, discarding elites, and empowering individuals. You find this strain of thought in every sector of our society. Think of the writer and reader in the age of Amazon's self-publishing platform, with Jeff Bezos promising the end of the gatekeepers, or the professional reporter, me, in the age of the citizen journalist on Reddit and Twitter. But across these sectors, the result is always the same. When you tear down the old structures, wealth and power become concentrated in the hands of fewer people. In a way, cosmopolitan America is the progressive counterpart to libertarian America. Now, cosmopolitan Americans are right to say that those old jobs are not coming back. A college education is the key to success. It's better to be open and tolerant than narrow and parochial and bigoted. But in its optimism about technology and the future, it's missed something important. In 2004, the political scientist Samuel Huntington published his last book, Who Are We? The Challenges to America's National Identity. It was a troubling book because it presented American democracy as a product of European and specifically Anglo-Protestant culture. Like warnings 100 years ago about Southern and Eastern European immigration, it argued that certain immigrants, especially Latin American Catholics, were not natural fits for America's national identity. The argument had an undeniable streak of racism in it. Huntington was expressing anxiety about the weakening of national bonds in contemporary America. He wanted a country of patriots who shared the same American culture and loved their country and were willing to fight for it. In my own magazine, The New Yorker, he was roundly mocked by a reviewer who wrote, "If the world is becoming more porous, more transnational, more tuned to the same economic, social, and informational frequency, if the globe is more global, which means more Americanized, then the need for national cultural homogeneity is lesser, not greater. The stronger societies will be the more cosmopolitan ones." Now, how do things look a decade and a half later? Whatever you think of Huntington, and I have a lot to say against him, he did have a clearer view of the forces shaping the near future than his critic. That passage is like a time capsule from a period when progressives thought that globalization was making national identities obsolete. The blind spot of cosmopolitan Americans is that they always underestimate most people's attachment to their country because they've lost it in themselves. As a result, they often fail to foresee the direction politics is taking. Nationalism can be turned to positive or negative uses, but it's a force that never completely disappears. In the last few years, we should have at least learned that. The third narrative of national identity is diverse America. It sees Americans as members of groups whose status is determined by the story of oppression, past and present. During the later Obama years, this came as a necessary corrective to the naive illusion that equal rights for all was a settled matter in this country. As a struggle to give all Americans a place at the table based on human rights and universal values, the narrative of diverse America is a force for immense good. But in our moment, it's becoming a dogma among cultural elites, one that dominates media, schools and universities, foundations, and the arts. It's become an end in itself. But even the just cause of inclusion is a dead end if we can't answer, included in what? What is the vision of national identity that is the sum of all these parts? The narrative of diverse America is fostered in schools from a very young age. I see it in my son's public elementary school education in New York City, where he's learning about all sorts of cultures, from African and Chinese to Mayan and Native American, but has not been taught the origin story of his own American Republic. My kids know something about our origin story. They know it from listening to Hamilton. They could tell you all about the fight over the establishment of the National Bank. And the greatness of Hamilton is not just its music and language, but its vision of inclusion that affirms a common American identity of its characters, its performers, and its audience. But Hamilton is not a replacement for civics, which no longer exists. Diverse America has replaced civics with an education that celebrates difference without teaching the concepts and the history, good and bad, achievement and failure, that underlie the struggle for equality. King demanded that America live out the true meaning of its creed. The most powerful voices today claim that the creed itself is foul. The very notion of American identity is taken to be a coercive whitewash. The narrative of diverse America gets codified in universities, particularly elite ones, where students receive their first and most decisive instruction from diversity officers. On many campuses, this is the true and only core curriculum. I understand their value, but I also understand the side effects. It can become a weapon against the open exchange of ideas, even free speech, which Brown University now defines as speech that makes all groups feel included. The focus lately has been on controversial, sometimes hateful speech, and efforts on campus, sometimes violent, to shut it down. But I'm actually less concerned by the tired ritual of attention-seeking charlatans and the mobs that confront them than I am by the subtle, daily, intellectual chill in college classrooms, the fear that keeps students of goodwill from participating in discussions that could land them on social media or in the campus paper. This chill is real enough that my professor friends will talk about it only if I assure them they're off the record. To me, it's all incredibly unfair to students. The products of these educations are less able or less willing to think in terms larger than their own group. It's a kind of intellectual narcissism, which means they cannot find common ground or effective arguments that can reach people of different backgrounds and views. Instead, they're taught to explore and affirm the contours of their own group. Diverse America is now reacting to Trump, and he's making it more extreme because he shrewdly sees it as his ally. It sounds more and more like the progressive echo of America First. Which brings me to the fourth narrative of national identity, the one that prevailed in the election. America First is the most superficially nationalistic of the four, but this nationalism is shallow, static, pessimistic, brittle. It's convinced that the country has lost its traditional identity because of contamination and weakness. The contamination of others, foreigners, Muslims, the weakness of elites who have no allegiance to the country because they've been globalized, they eat sushi and attend conferences in Dubai and go on vacations in Australia. The elites have betrayed the true patriots. This nationalism isn't based on the ideas in the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, and the Emancipation Proclamation, but in the blood and soil of the heartland. That's where the real America is found, among the common people, the white Christian inhabitants of the towns and farms. One thing to notice about the idea of America First is that it actually sounds pretty foreign. It sounds European. Last July, Trump gave a speech before a rapturous crowd in Warsaw, in which he named the enemies of Western civilization radical Islamic terrorists, and government bureaucrats. The poor bureaucrats, they're just doing their job. Trump declared, quote, "Americans, Poles, and the nations of Europe value individual freedom and sovereignty. We must work together to confront forces, whether they come from inside or out, from the South or the East, that threaten over time to undermine these values, to erase the bonds of culture, faith, and tradition that make us who we are." He led the Polish crowd in a chant of, "We want God," which meant the Christian God. I picture Trump in a white uniform with a red sash and gold braiding. He sounded more like Francisco Franco than James Madison. Culture, faith, tradition, not self-government, not democracy. His rhetoric is not in the conservative American grain, it's reactionary. This is the meaning of Make America Great Again. Though the phrase invokes nostalgia for an imagined past, it has nothing to do with the past, the actual past. It's a radical call to sweep away the established order. It even has something in common with its arch enemy, radical Islamism, which is also obsessed with conspiracies, treacherous elites, purification, and an imaginary golden age. America First is built on the myth of the people, the true folk, or better yet, the Volk, who do the work and fight the wars and are betrayed and forgotten by the decadent rulers in the imperial center. This narrative comes with an autocratic character and contempt for liberal values and democratic norms. It personalizes power, routinizes corruption, destabilizes the very idea of objective truth. It's the greatest threat to American democracy in my lifetime. I realize there are other ways to discuss the question of American identity today, but these are the narratives that strike me as strongest. Most Americans, without thinking about it much, subscribe to one or another, perhaps to some combination of them. One thing to notice is that all of them create winners and losers. In libertarian America, the winners are the makers and the losers are the takers. Mitt Romney's 47%. In cosmopolitan America, the winners are the meritocrats. The losers are the poorly educated, so loved by Trump. In diverse America, groups fight for their claims against the claims of others, including the soon-to-be minority majority group. And in America First, It's the true people against the elites and the aliens. Each narrative pits tribe against tribe. Each tribe imagines that the others are illegitimate and will eventually somehow disappear by being defeated at the polls or overtaken by demography or walled off or just by dying off. None of them has much conviction in the values and institutions of American democracy. It's always fallen short of the ideal, but what's new is a sense that the ideal itself might not be worth the effort. So I would like to leave you with another narrative, but I don't have one yet. I'm working on it. Sorry, I know. And if you do, let me know, because this is a work in progress. But what I do have is a bunch of worries and an aspiration. By now, you know the worries. So here's the aspiration. First, let's recognize that you cannot avoid the struggle to define national identity. If you try, you'll abandon the field to the ugliest version, because people feel attached to their country as they do to their family. So instead of wishing national identity away, we should define it in the most inclusive terms possible, terms that get away from tribalism. The most inclusive category I know is that of citizen. But it can be hollow for Americans who are shut out because of who they are, or where they live, or where they come from, or how much they make. So the first step is to remove those barriers, and again, and again. The second is to relearn how to talk and listen to one another. Not to pretend that there are no fundamental differences between us, because there are, and they run deep. But each of us should make the hard effort to get out of our bubble, to try to get into the heads of Americans who don't think like us, to find a language that will allow us to discuss and argue and disagree as fellow citizens, rather than to obliterate each other as enemies. A third step is to restore civics to our children's education. I don't just mean how a bill becomes a law and what's in the Constitution, although it would be nice if more than a quarter of Americans could identify the three branches of government, and more than half could name at least one of the rights in the First Amendment. I mean that the highest purpose of education should be to create democratic citizens. By all means, let's teach children the critique of American democracy. But let's also teach them the idea so that they know what it is we're critiquing, in what way we've fallen short, and why that matters. I know being citizen sounds pretty namby-pamby, but it isn't. It's hard work, and it often feels like failure. I'm not telling you to tone it down, be polite, pretend we can all agree, when in fact there are fundamental values at stake that Americans will never agree on. What I'm saying is that we should be more militant, but not for my tribe or yours, for our democracy itself. Thank you.
That was George Packer speaking in Eugene in January 2018. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.